The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're getting quite a lot of rain last night and this morning, so it's much needed. I don't think I've ever seen the Edstone grass as brown as it's been the last couple of weeks. So anyway, when it came down last night, it really did pour on the surrounding areas here. I made my way into Stratford to go to Tesco, and a lot of the parking lot was flooded out because it had rained so hard. It was almost like an Oklahoma rain. Today it's a pretty hard rain, or at least it has been on and off, but a little bit more normal or similar to the way it is in the past with the UK. Before the rain set in this morning, by the way, we've got some pretty dramatic footage out at the bird feeder. You can see these birds at the start. This is, again, before the downpour came in. Go ahead and roll the footage, Sam. There they are, having a blast. I think six on the bird feeder. At its peak, five goldfinches. I think the nuthatch just took off. And then we have all of our windows open, all of our doors open to the decks because it's nice and cool out. And so Arnold took advantage of this, got a drink from the bird bath, which I didn't have to fill up thanks to the rain. So that was nice. He walks around the bird bath and then just basically sets up on this side, the near side. There he is looking back at my office window. And incredibly, this bird fly, you can't see it in the screen right now. It's on the top of that chair. But then the bird goes ahead and lands on the top platform with Arnold just beneath. And take a look at this this attack. We've got it again in slow motion. You can rate Arnold's skills. Because truthfully, I'm a little disappointed. I think he's sitting in front of a platform, a bird feeder, and he literally is fed a bird on a platter. It's right there in front of him. And judging by the wildlife that he routinely brings to our back door, as I say, I would have expected better. He just knocked it over, and the bird took off, and then Arnold took off. It was as if he was afraid or shocked by all of the action as well. In any event, I was doing some math this morning. We got him right when we first got to Edstone, which means he's almost 6 years of age. That's that amounts to what, 6 times 7? So he's 42 now. He's in his 40s. So maybe his middle age is starting to show. I was expecting him to go in for the kill. Anyway, there's a little excitement from just a couple of hours ago, right outside my my office window. We haven't gotten to some listener feedback in quite a while. Hopefully we can get through some. Well, we'll get through a few right here at the start. And then if we have time later on in the show, we'll get to some that have been sitting in the pile for quite some time. This listener says, learning so much from the show. I love the TD, the real news about the fake news, it says. So happy God inspired this program. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Another one writes, good morning, Trumpet Daily crew. Catching a bit of news before heading to bed, watching live in Papua New Guinea. Enjoy the rest of the week. And then this one came, I think, in response not to yesterday, but the day before. But a new listener from Northern Ireland. And she says, I discovered your radio show during lockdown and have been tuning in daily ever since. So we've heard from a few new listeners over the last few months, and perhaps the lockdown in that sense is helping. It says, it's been refreshing to listen to some grounded, sensible reporting, bringing the Bible and its relevance into the news of the world today. Having listened to the Trumpet Daily on the 12th of August, I felt compelled to write to you again. As a shop owner, she saw the footage of that Black Lives Matter representative in Chicago, basically saying, hey, it's okay. You know, these looters, they need to be able to eat. So they should be able to steal. They should be able to cause all of this damage because these shop owners have insurance anyway. So everyone benefits. And Black Lives Matter, by the way, was behind that. Totally, totally behind those attacks on Chicago Sunday night. This is the movement, the Marxist movement. And then their representatives are out there in front of the cameras saying that, yeah, that was the goal. And looting is fine. They're basically advocating for violence and criminal behavior. They're advocating for violence and looting and smashing and burning. Well, this listener has a shop of her own in Northern Ireland. And she says, as a shop owner myself, I couldn't believe what I was hearing when the BLM leader justified the looting and destruction by saying they have insurance. They have insurance. And the media, they won't show you the pictures from Portland, Seattle, Chicago, New York. They won't show you the pictures. All these shops boarded up. Minneapolis? I mentioned that just the other day. That Fox News reporter that went in there and basically you got all these shop owners that are saying, you know, where's the help? Is the city going to try to help us rebuild? Well, I guess BLM would respond to that and say, well, don't you have insurance? This listener says, firstly, she assumes that all the businesses have insurance. She's assuming that their insurance covers looting. And I'm sure not all insurance policies do. But anyway, the point that she makes here is that somebody has to pay for this, even if it's the insurance companies. It says, secondly, here in Northern Ireland, riot and civil commotion is not covered by your insurance company. Maybe it's different in America. So here's a shop owner in Northern Ireland saying that's generally not covered. So who has to pay the bill? Who has to pay the bill for all this destruction? It says, thirdly, someone does have to pay for the damage. If or when these businesses try to renew their policies, they will find the premiums have gone way up. That is, if they can even get insurance to cover it. And then fourthly, she writes, as for the masses who were prepared to travel to these shops with the aim of looting, I have no words. They just brought them in on caravans, caravans of cars and vans, dropping off the looters. Hey, listen up, they said on social media. The police in Chicago gunned down a little black boy. That's what they said. They gunned down a little black boy. And of course, that didn't happen at all. In fact, it was a 20-year-old. A 20-year-old young black man who shot first at police officers. And then they returned fire. And now that young man's in the hospital. He didn't die. At least from the last report I saw. But here they go on social media, they tell lies, and then the looters show up in full force, and then Black Lives Matter defends it, saying, well, the shop owners have insurance anyway. It's despicable. The media, the Democrats, they can't even bring themselves to criticize this behavior, this criminal activity. I'll come to that in just a second with Kamala Harris. She gave her first big speech yesterday. Now that she's Joe Biden's running mate, did she come out and condemn Antifa? Did she come out and condemn Black Lives Matter and what they're doing to the cities of America? Not at all. Far from it. They are on the side of the rioters, the looters. This is their movement, and so they won't dare criticize it. And then the media, doing their part, of course, are there to heap praise on Kamala Harris and on these protesters. There's this big push now to make her out, Kamala Harris, to make her out to be a moderate, and she's far from moderate in her political views. She is a radical. And you can go back to the early stages of that Democrat primary at the end of last year and see just how on board she was with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's economic policies, her disastrous economic policies, the Green New Deal, all of those left-wing agendas. And then you have, too, the fact that she had to bail out of the race so early. So there's quite a few commentators pointing out that, you know, she really wasn't that popular. She doesn't have a very high likability rating. She was really going at it with Joe Biden as well, accusing him of racism, accusing him of assaulting women even. And now the two have come together. I guess they've healed that breach between them. But you go back to the first two. I guess she was on the ticket in, Sam pointed this out, New Hampshire and then in Arkansas, Kamala Harris. In New Hampshire, she pulled in 129 votes. That's votes, not delegates, votes. 129 people. And then she got 715 in Arkansas. And then that was it. She was out. She was supposed to be a big deal last year at the end of the year. And now, of course, you listen to the news coverage today, and she is a big deal. She's perfect. She's perfect for the Democratic ticket. This was CNN's reaction yesterday to her speech. I think the speech was 15, 20 minutes. But listen to these reporters talking about this speech that Kamala Harris gave after Joe Biden introduced her. Clip one.
I thought Kamala Harris gave a fantastic speech. She absolutely nailed it. I think this is one of the finest performances I've seen her deliver.
It's as though she was saying them from the mountaintop as opposed to, you know, just a high school gymnasium there.
She gave a very powerful speech.
These were two extremely strong, pointed speeches.
It was a beautiful speech, both of them.
She's incredibly warm and funny and light. She's talking about spending time with her nieces and her stepkids.
What we saw here today was the passing of the torch.
She was, I thought, fabulous.
That was such a beautiful thing to see.
There was a relaxed quality to her while delivering, you know, some blistering lines of attack.
It's medicine right now. People need to feel that somebody gets them.
I think this was a tremendous effort.
Today the tables were turned and it was her turn to go after him.
Real, I think, complete package.
I think if you're going to give a headline today, it would be Hope Reborn. That's what I felt. Hope Reborn.
This was a tremendous effort by her.
The ease in which they worked together was very apparent.
She is able to punch through and yet do it in a way that is very relaxed and conversational.
She really did a fantastic job, and I'm sure Donald Trump is watching this and he's nervous.
I think also she did a great job of just describing what people are going through.
There was a lightness to her.
I think it met the moment. This is a serious time, and of course it's the third anniversary of Charlottesville. It's the reason that Joe Biden got into this race after all, and it makes perfect sense that he introduced his running mate.
I think CNN, I think they're behind this. I think they like the choice. That montage, by the way, is put together by Newsbusters. But there have been a few stories about just the way the media treated Sarah Palin back in 2008 when she joined John McCain's ticket. They saw Palin as a threat, and so they went after her. They were ruthless in their attempt to destroy that woman. Now it's all about the woman that's joined the ticket, not just a woman of color, but boy, when it's someone that opposes their political views, they don't count. It's like Joe Biden said about black people that wouldn't vote for him. They don't really count. They're not really black. They're sellouts. But when they agree ideologically, then you get montages like that. She can do no wrong. And speaking of CNN, there was one reporter, I think this was on his Twitter feed, but he talked about her being the perfect successor for when Joe Biden steps aside. What does he mean by that? Are they already preparing for him not even making it through his first term? He's getting up there in age. He's slowing down, as many people have noted. And she comes from the far left. She is a radical. They want to say Joe Biden's a moderate. They want to say that Kamala Harris is a moderate. And in fact, both of them are proof that the far left, the radical left, has taken hold of the Democrat Party. And if you want to do well within that party, you have to swing far to the left. I'll get a little bit into her career as a prosecutor and an attorney general out in California and a book she wrote back in 2010. But she comes from California, as I say, and I'll just refer you to an article my father wrote in 2007 about the midterm elections. This was when Nancy Pelosi's Democrats swept into power. They claimed a majority back at the end of 2006. And my father said here, and that article really, it really does say a lot about where we are today, at least on the left of the political spectrum. It says, Democrats are excited by the fact that endorsements of San Francisco values now echo through Washington's halls. Is this what America needs? Prior to the elections, one newspaper stated, if Democrats win, Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker, and her far-left San Francisco values, and then it lists them all off. And this is what Kamala Harris comes from. The far, in fact, she comes from that very region, Northern California, Berkeley, that crowd. Now she's right there with Joe Biden. And yet if you look at this, this too demonstrates just how dramatic the change has been, the transformation has been in the Democrat Party. Just looking at the career of these two, both of them have been strong on crime in their past. Joe Biden, as Sam was saying this morning, really, these two are everything that the woke mob says it despises. Here he's an old white man who, in the 1990s anyway, he was tough. He was tough. He was on the side of tough law enforcement. For a Democrat, he was pretty tough. And then Kamala Harris, she, as I say, she used to work in law enforcement. This was her book in 2010, Smart on Crime. Listen to this summary. This is taken from, I think, Apple Books. But it's a 2010 book, so it's 10 years old. And the summary of the book says, the old approaches to fighting crime just aren't working. Two-thirds of people released from prison commit another crime within 2 years. So she was concerned back then, 10 years ago, about these criminals getting out of prison and then committing another crime. And of course, now the far left, the radical left, they just want to open the prison doors all over the place. They've even used COVID-19 as an excuse to release prisoners. It says here, in Smart on Crime, career prosecutor Kamala Harris shatters the old distinctions rooted in false choices and myths and offers a compelling argument for how to make the criminal justice system truly, not just rhetorically, but truly tough. She wanted to make the criminal justice system tough. It says Harris spells out the necessary shifts that will increase public safety, reduce costs, and strengthen our communities when our politicians and law enforcement officials learn how to become tough and smart on crime. You think she's going to be out on the stump talking about getting tough on crime? No, not at all. You look at their history, though. Candace Owens, she's the black conservative woman that we've played clips from her quite often. But she sent out a tweet jokingly saying that they ought to choose mass incarcerate America again as their slogan. Because they've had a history with that. Put them in jail. If they're thugs, if they've committed crimes, they ought to go to jail. They ought to go to prison. But now you see how dramatic and how far-reaching this swing to the left is for the Democrat Party. Yesterday in her speech, listen to the way she described all of this violence that's just racing across the United States, that's infecting all of these dark blue cities with Democrats leading them for decades in some cases. Here's clip two.
And we're experiencing a moral reckoning with racism and systemic injustice that has brought a new coalition of conscience to the streets of our country demanding change.
a coalition of conscience to the streets of America. That's how she describes the protests, and it's not much different than CNN, obviously. It's mostly peaceful. It's necessary. It's a moral reckoning. We've got to have a conversation, as she often says, about systemic injustice. We're going to be having a lot of conversations that she wouldn't have been having 10 years ago, that Joe Biden wouldn't have been having in the 1990s. But now, because the radical left has taken over that party, everyone is woke. Everyone is on board. Everyone is part of the revolution. They're all supporting the mob. They're all supporters of the mob violence. We told you about Seattle earlier this week. This police chief, they've defunded. Here, Seattle's not that far removed from Portland. Portland's probably the worst. Portland's probably never going to recover. It's downtown area. But there's also parts of downtown Seattle, thanks to Chaz and Chop and all that that went on a month or so ago, that are never going to be the same. Shop owners that probably will never return. And even in the midst of this, you have these Seattle council members voting to defund the police, voting to slash the police chief's salary. What was it? I think it was 140 policemen that were laid off because of this defunding, this push to defund. So the police chief, Carmen Best, she's a black woman, by the way. She's a woman of color. She resigns in protest, and listen to her explanation, clip three.
This is not about the money, and it certainly isn't about, you know, the demonstrators. I mean, be real, I have a lot thicker skin than that. It really is about the overarching lack of respect for the officers, the men and women who work so hard day in and day out.
She's stepping aside because of the general disrespect, the lack of respect for law enforcement. Because of what's happening to our cities, and because of the way the police are being treated. They're being treated worse than the mobsters. That's the truth. In Portland, Seattle, Minneapolis, New York, Chicago, the police are being treated worse than the mobsters. Worse than those that are rioting. There's a story coming out of the county, Multnomah, I guess is how you pronounce it. That's the county that encompasses Portland. But the new prosecutor there, he came into his office just a couple weeks ago, and he announced that he's not going to prosecute any of these rioters. How about that? Here's the new prosecuting attorney. And he announces straight away, listen, I'm not going to go after any of the rioters. I'm not going to stop any of that. I'm not going to prosecute them. He's basically saying we're going to give them some space to destroy. Just like that Baltimore police chief or mayor said several years ago. Give them space. Let them do what they want. Now the police, let's fire them. Now the police, let's get rid of them. But the rioters, we're just going to let it go. We're just going to give them space. We're going to let them do their thing. We don't mind if it turns into what happened in Chicago the other night. How long has it been going on in Portland? Almost 3 months. 3 months of this. And now they're walking down residential streets and they're screaming at the top of their lungs in the middle of the night, telling these people in houses to wake up and to acknowledge their white privilege or to repent of their capitalist leanings. It's astounding to me that the politicians, particularly in such a significant election coming up in November, that they actually believe this is a winning strategy. I think there's probably still a majority of Americans, as bad as it is, as steeped as we are in our sins, for sure, I think there's still a majority of Americans that would prefer living in states, living in cities, or living near cities that aren't going up in flames, where the law enforcement hasn't stepped back and just given way to the anarchists. They think it's a winning strategy, I guess. This is what Kamala Harris said about the COVID-19 coup, and that's what it is. They've used this crisis to also go after President Trump. Clip four.
The president's mismanagement of the pandemic has plunged us into the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
It's the president's fault, of course. It's always his fault. And as I've said over and again, that article from American Greatness, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, how that this is not brought on by the pandemic. These are the elites that have imposed these lockdown measures on the people. The president, in his press conference yesterday, and I think it went on for almost an hour, this is a president who is accessible, no matter what you think about him. He goes out there every day. He takes questions from the reporters who hate him every day. And here's one reporter asking him if he had heard about what Kamala Harris said regarding his handling of COVID-19. Clip five.
She said that your refusal to get testing up and running, you're flip-flopping on social distancing and masks, and your delusional belief that you know better than the experts. All of that, in her words, a reason that one American dies of COVID-19 every minute. What do you think of that?
I think that's probably one of the reasons she was a terrible candidate and was forced to leave the race, because she got her facts wrong. You know, she's very bad on facts. She's very weak on facts. And just so you understand, we've done more testing than any country in the world by far. That includes India, which has 1.5 billion people. That includes China. That includes every country in the world. We've done more testing. We have better testing than any country in the world. They call. They want to know, where do we get it? How do we get it? We have better testing than any country in the world. When you do as much testing as us, however, as you understand, you develop more cases. If you tested on a set of 65 million people, which is what we've done, when you test that many people, you're going to find cases that normally you wouldn't see. And on top of that, when you look at the numbers, how we were impacted less than these other countries, and now you look at the explosion of countries that you would have said did such a good job, and some of them had advantages over us for obvious reasons having to do with the pandemic. But when you look at the job that we've done compared to others, we've done a great job. And I read today that she's very short on facts. I think she's going to be a big failure. And I look forward to the debate between her and Mike Pence.
So that's President Trump responding to what Kamala Harris said regarding his handling of the pandemic, talking about the number of tests that the United States has taken and how that there's obviously going to be more cases and such. He doesn't seem too afraid of this particular candidate and how that she might measure up to or match up against his vice president, Mike Pence. Step back just for a moment, though. You think about the Democrats, the radical left, how they're using this pandemic, this crisis, to destroy their political opposition. And think about for a moment what it's doing to the nation. My father's talked before about, even after that dispute following the election of George W. Bush in 2000, and he asked then, remember, that was 20 years ago, do these people really love the Constitution and the United States more than they love themselves, or more than they love their own party, their own political party? Look at what's happening to America in the news stack this morning. The U.S. borrowed $2.81 trillion in just the first 10 months of this budget year, more than any other year on record. Richard was saying that by the end of this year, we're expected to borrow more than double any other year on record. I mean, this is so much worse than 2009. Following that financial meltdown, now, there's a nice recovery that's happening at the perfect time for President Trump, which is only going to help his reelection chances. That and the mayhem on the streets, of course, as I said earlier. But looking at the bigger picture, to borrow $2, $3, maybe $4 trillion, the Democrats and the Republicans right now are They're arguing over, they're fighting over how big of a package to introduce here in the next few months. The Dems want $3 trillion more. And the Republicans want something like a trillion, just a measly trillion. Trillion here, trillion there. What is it doing to our country? Look at what it's doing to the UK. I mentioned all these social programs going on to try to now stimulate the economy as the curve has been flattened. There was a story about the number of deaths, COVID-related deaths here in the UK, and how that they've probably miscalculated. It's probably lower by about 5,000 or 6,000. In fact, they've readjusted their numbers. Because early on, they used to say, well, if so-and-so had COVID, you know, 5, 6, 7 weeks ago, and then feels better now, but then died of something else, if COVID was way back in the history there, then they're a COVID-related death. That's the way they were counting them. And now they're going in and recounting. So they've adjusted or downgraded the total from 46,700 to about 41,300. That's a pretty significant readjustment. And Richard said the most dramatic readjustment has come from the month of July, just last month. Last month, when we were told about the second wave is coming, we're going to have more people die if we don't extend the lockdown, if we don't make mask wearing mandatory. And we come to find out that the miscalculations were pretty, I mean, just gross errors in the month of July. Says here, for example, Public Health England's most recent week, I think this is Richard commenting on the news, the most recent data that they've published is for July 18 to 24. The official number of COVID deaths has been cut that week from 442 to 111. And of course, Richard's point in a little email exchange we had this morning was that it was July. It was in July when it seemed like the wave was really taking off again, that they put in place the mandatory mask wearing and that sort of thing. And it was all based on faulty numbers. Just like the whole lockdown to begin with. You remember Neil Ferguson? You remember what he was projecting early on? And that total lockdown happening in the middle of March, it was based on bogus numbers. It was based on bad math. It was based on scaremongering. All of these projections that turned out to be false, that turned out to be lies, that turned out to be, well, maybe wishful thinking on the part of the experts. The Telegraph had a piece here today about Sweden. You'll recall that they were one of the few that said, we're not going to go along with this lockdown mania. We're going to keep things open. We're going to be sensible. We're going to encourage people to wash their hands, to quarantine themselves if they get sick. But life goes on. That's the approach that Sweden took. It says here, shocking incompetence has unnecessarily wiped billions of pounds from the UK economy. So now we know, listen to this, Sweden got it largely right, and the British establishment catastrophically wrong. It says Anders Tegnell, Stockholm's epidemiologist king, has pulled off a remarkable triple whammy. Far fewer deaths per capita than Britain, a maintenance of basic freedoms and opportunities, including schooling, and most strikingly, a recession less than half as severe as our own. I played that clip for you yesterday from Sky News. Well, the facts are in, and boy, I tell you, this is not good. GDP down 20.4%. We knew it was bad, but we never knew it would be this bad. How come anyone, well, it's amazing you don't have the people giving their projection about what this is going to do to the economy. A few people did, I guess. I mean, we cover some of that on our program, but they don't listen to those experts. It's just the medical experts, the power, just like Mr. Armstrong said in the healing booklet, the power that these experts have. At the Telegraph, it says here, our arrogant quangocrats, I'll have to look that one up, and state experts should hang their heads in shame, it says. Their reaction to coronavirus was one of the greatest public policy blunders in modern history. More severe even than Iraq, Afghanistan, the financial crisis, Suez, or the ERM fiasco. Millions will lose their jobs when furlough ends. Tens of thousands of small businesses are failing. Schooling is in crisis, or chaos, it says there. So why can't we just look at Sweden and say, you know what, we got it wrong. Let's end this nonsense. Let's carry on with life. They're not prepared to do it. When we come back, we'll finish off our study on Abraham Lincoln. And then, as I say, hopefully we'll have a little extra time at the end of the program to get to some listener feedback. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course is a distance learning program that makes the Bible clear and understandable. The correspondence course enables enrollees to learn what the Bible itself says about subjects that affect you and the world you live in. This fascinating Bible course highlights and proves what the Bible says about morality, war, religion, terrorism, and other current events, focusing on the root causes of this world's many problems facing man, as well as their solutions. The Bible and this course also focuses on the reason mankind was created in the first place, the way to happiness, accomplishment, and fulfillment, as well as the truth behind important doctrinal questions, such as what happens after we die, the nature of God, the resurrection, the millennium, and other critical subjects. Enroll today in the Herbert W. Armstrong Bible Correspondence Course. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Quangocrat, Sam Googled it, says it's based on the word bureaucrat, referring to a member of a quango, which is a quasi-autonomous, non-governmental organization. Those whose jobs will be most at risk are quangocrats. So that is from the Telegraph this morning. Our reliance, our over-reliance on the quangocrats to lock everything down. You're learning quite a lot on today's show. Birds, we've had a National Geographic type of production at the end. That video at the start, by the way, that was the third version of it. Sam was probably wondering, how many edits are we going to make on this silly video? But look at how it turned out. It's perfect. It's perfect. All right, we'll finish with Lincoln. There's Arnold making his attack. We've played these clips from President Trump's speech at Mount Rushmore, where he talked about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt and of course, Abraham Lincoln. And here he is back in the first part of July talking about how Lincoln saved the nation. This is clip 7.
Abraham Lincoln, the savior of our Union, was a self-taught country lawyer who grew up in a log cabin on the American frontier. The first Republican president, he rose to high office from obscurity based on a force and clarity of his anti-slavery convictions, very, very strong convictions.
That's President Trump back in July, speaking of Abraham Lincoln, the savior of our nation. My father in that program from the 1990s said that he sounded like a prophet of God, issuing those Thanksgiving proclamations, calling upon Americans to pray, to fast, I mentioned this quote from the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy yesterday. Mr. Armstrong, remember, he relied on that that famous quote from Lincoln's Lyceum Address back when Lincoln was just 28 years of age. It says here in the U.S. and Britain, and because Lincoln saw a nation who had forgotten God, a nation drunk with a success not due to its own efforts, a nation taking all the credit and glory to itself, this great president, that's what Mr. Armstrong called him, this great president called upon the nation for a day of fasting and prayer to confess this national sin before God. We need to go to God and confess this national sin of ours. It says the fate of the nation hung in the balance when he issued that proclamation. And then Mr. Armstrong says, but God heard and answered that great national prayer offensive, and the nation was then preserved. So that's Herbert Armstrong saying that God heard that prayer offensive during the 1860s. God used Abraham Lincoln to save America. He was speaking almost like a prophet. What a lesson there is in this history. Think about how easy it is to forget those blessings or to take for granted those times God intervened in our lives. God intervened in our church. God intervened in our nation, our nation's history. Here he was calling on a day of national prayer and humiliation. Who uses that word today? We need to humiliate ourselves before God. We need a day of prayer, fasting, and humiliation. Why? Well, listen to this proclamation from 1861. Lincoln urged Americans to, quote, humble ourselves before him and to pray for his mercy, to pray that we may be spared further punishment, though most justly deserved. In other words, we deserve the punishment, so we better pray that we're spared further punishment. We better call upon God for mercy. But that's a U.S. president saying, basically, you know, we deserve this. We brought this on ourselves. It's because of our own sins. That was a great man. God shaped and formed that man's course, that life, that trajectory he was on, that man's education, his training, his study of the Bible. You can go back to that Key of David from my father just a couple months ago. I think it was in June. How Lincoln won the Civil War. He's responsible. He had some pretty significant help there at the end from Ulysses Grant. Not a lot of help from anyone else. How he won. Some of you might be familiar with the history. I think there was a historian, a modern historian, that wrote a book with the title Team of Rivals, and how that when Lincoln came into office, in an effort to unify the country, he brought some of his fiercest political opponents into his cabinet just to make a statement, just to show the country that we're going to come together. Enough with this. One side says the other side should be in jail, and then the other side says that side should be in jail. We need to come together. We need to unify. One of the ones that really hated Lincoln most was Edwin Stanton. He had talked about Lincoln in public. He said Lincoln was low. He was a cunning clown. He said he was the original gorilla. Insulting him in public. But Lincoln made him Secretary of War because he felt like Stanton was the best man for the job. This is from Sandburg's book. It says, when a friend reported to Lincoln that even as a cabinet member, so even when he came into the cabinet, Stanton called the president a fool. Lincoln calmly replied, "Did he call me that? Well, I reckon it must be true, for Stanton is generally right." Just kind of laughed it off. Called him a fool. And yet when Lincoln died just a few years later, he was assassinated, as we well know. He was assassinated for what he did for the country, for what he did to eradicate slavery from our midst. He was killed by an assassin's bullet in 1865. And while on his deathbed, Stanton, who had issued all those insults over the years, Stanton was just sobbing alongside the bed, and he said, "There lies the greatest ruler of men that the world has ever seen." See, he knew by the end that this was a great man. He knew by the end that this was the savior of the nation. He was like a prophet of God almost. William Herndon, that was Lincoln's law partner. He worked with Lincoln. He wrote a book about Lincoln after Lincoln died. It says, he saw as, this is him commenting on Lincoln, he saw as the main feature of Lincoln's life, the far more than ordinary rise of a self-made man. He says, a rise from the lowest depths to the greatest heights. Well, basically, I'm kind of butchering the quote, but Herndon, basically, for those that, you know, wrote later and almost deified Lincoln, Herndon was upset by that and said that, look, he put in his work. He put in his effort. This was just an ordinary man who did extraordinary things. And as we covered yesterday, he looked to God. He prayed to God when it looked like it was really going to go against the North there before Gettysburg and enduring. He prayed for God's intervention. It shows what kind of impact righteous leadership can have on an entire nation. It shows what kind of leadership, what kind of impact a leader can have if he's standing firm on a strong foundation. I'll leave it to you to look at Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27, where it talks about that sure foundation on which we need to be fastened. God says if we're not on that, as soon as a storm comes along, there's going to be a great crash. Great will be the fall of it. That's what it says at the end of Matthew 7. But I'll leave you with this proverb. Listen to this proverb from, and this ties in with not just what we've studied on Lincoln, but some of the other great and towering figures of history as well. Proverbs 29, though, in verse 2, it says, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked bear rule, the people mourn." When there's a righteous leader at the helm, the people will rejoice. The people will embrace him. I saw this clip this morning. We're going to put together a segment on it for next week, perhaps. All of these black Americans coming out of the White House at some event from a few months ago and just raving about President Trump and his leadership. That's quite a point of division in the United States today, the Trump administration. But it was just refreshing to see all of these black Americans actually saying positive things about their president, because he is their president. As I say, hopefully we'll have a few more things to say about that segment next week. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with some listener feedback that's come in over the last few weeks. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit feedback, you can write us, td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. from the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Some comments here from you listeners. Another one, or one of our listeners says, wow, so interesting to hear what President Abraham Lincoln said years ago, and to see how much our country has changed from a God-fearing country to a country so deceived and so divided. It says, it makes me so sad. Another listener says, America really is under attack, and having a good understanding of early childhood education and social emotional development, whatever we feed our minds, our actions will show. America really is in a psychological warfare. Thank you for showing that. Satan is behind the radical left movement, which is all about destroying the Constitution, which is based on God's law. This one here says, one definition of passion reads like this: a strong or extravagant fondness, enthusiasm, or desire for anything. It says passion is a powerful way to communicate to the masses. Unfortunately, some leaders use passion to entice, to agitate, to mold mindsets, to perform, think, or act in certain ways. And he gives some examples of people that use it the wrong way. Passion has also motivated space exploration, engineering marvels, and athletic prowess. These are at least honorable, but fall short of man's incredible human potential. It says, your program is different. You and your group have passion for the truth, plain as it may seem, but known only by a few. So that's a nice comment there about a godly type passion that we ought to aim for. Another one here says, here where I live in Western New York State, PBS has been running almost continually each week a special produced by Ken Burns about the Roosevelt family and their accomplishments. Great history. Thank God for programs like yours that gives the truth. Keep up the great work. All right, and then another one here from California writes, we have loved listening to you and really enjoyed hearing about SCP and all that you've done to make it more educational for these youths. We were excited to see Christopher Eames getting married to such an amazing lady, and can't wait to see that support for God's work increase. It says godly marriage is such a needed blessing. Thank you so much for keeping us up to date and focused during these really crazy times. You help keep us grounded and give us vision. I have a friend who is trying to figure out this world and has been seeing a lot through all of this. She even listened to Mr. Hilliker when he interviewed the author of Breaking Stalin's Nose, and she loved it. She also loved hearing Yuri Bezmenov speak. So that's someone who's been exposed to one of our programs on KPCG. This email comes from Texas. It says, it's amazing to me how much I've learned from this program. Thanks for all the history lessons. During the break on a recent program, the promotion for your Great Again book asked two questions. Do you believe the United States has been a positive force for most of its history? Do you believe that at one time America was a great nation? It was somewhat startling to realize I've only really learned about America and its history from this program. Probably less than 1% of the population actually has had enough sufficient education to even answer those questions. I couldn't have really answered those questions even a few months ago. The gross materialism and deeply selfish, lethargic state of the population is pitiable. I count myself deeply blessed to now have a clue about our national history. I ordered new license plates with the American flag on them and have been teaching my children to love our nation, to know what we have done to destroy the institution of slavery. How many lives have been slashed for all men to be free? That history of massive sacrifice for freedom does make my heart swell with gratitude. It says, I admire the men who fought. I adore Abraham Lincoln's cause. One final one here says, this is from California, thank you so much for the recent program about the absolute insanity of mandatory mask wearing. I echo your comments that there is no proof of its validity and that it actually causes more harm than good. I speak from experience. The company I work for has just recently required us to wear a mask inside their facility on our shifts. It says, I work in a warehouse where there is ample space between us all because we are at a reduced staff size anyway due to COVID. So there's hardly anyone in the warehouse. Most of the techie staff work from home now. But since four more people were being called back, that means more contact with each other, which could potentially put more at risk of contracting the disease. It says, of those four people, only one is on our side of the building. We all are spaced out in our areas where we work independently. Well, I'm running out of time, but basically this is a listener who says, I kept the mask on for 7.5 hours in a day. And this was an avid exerciser, you know, outdoorsman, that kind of thing, and a jogger. But he was commenting on just how difficult it is to get the strength to exercise after work, after inhaling everything that you've exhaled all day long. So that's someone not real happy about the approach to good health and vibrance that the experts have put us on. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit feedback, you can write us at td@kpcg.fm. We thank you for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.